who, all things considered, and a commentator for Mississippi Public Radio. His name is R. Scott Bruner. A collection of his essays on life in the South is just out from Villard Books. Its title, Due South, Dispatches from Down Home. Scott is a native of Bessemer, Alabama, 469 miles south of Urbana. He spent a good deal of time as a child on his grandparents' farm near Parrish, Alabama. Today, he and his wife, Karen, and their three children live in Jackson, Mississippi. Join our conversation with a telephone call this afternoon. Questions and comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Scott, good afternoon. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear your voice. How's the family?
Everyone's well. We've gone through a week of summer colds, so other than that, I think we're doing great.
Oh, good. Okay. When were you first aware of being a Southerner? When did that element of your identity rise to your consciousness?
It is so embedded in who I am, I think, that I don't know if I could ever determine a single point when it happened. So much of who I am and how I think and the things that I do are began long before my life began. They started back with my grandfather's life, or perhaps his parents' lives, because so many of those traditions and customs, everything from how we talk to how we cook and what we think about politics even, come from him, and they're just a part of my makeup.
Yeah. Well, I don't think of myself as a Northerner, but as a Midwesterner, although I don't think that I have a real strong sense of what it means to be a Midwesterner exactly. I think that people from the South, this is my assumption, that there's a stronger sense of geography, of regionalism there than here.
I think that is probably true. There is definitely something unique about being a Southerner. We have a really strong sense of place that is more than geography. It has to do with knowing who we are and who our parents were, and a real tie to our past.
Do you see signs that regional distinctions are less pronounced than they have been in the past?
Oh, they are, and sometimes to my dismay, we are becoming a very homogeneous culture. You can drive down any highway in the South and see McDonald's and Walmart's, and you could be on that. You could be on a highway anywhere in the country and see those same things. But the South, as a distinct region, is probably off the beaten path. In Due South, in one of the essays in the book, I comment about my experience in coming face to face with what is truly the South in a little barbecue joint in Collins, Mississippi, and I think the South there is expressed in the kindness that we show to one another, to a group of men who get together and over lunch and share jokes, and when their food comes, they take off their caps and they say grace, and it's just a slower pace and a sense of civility that is so lacking, I guess, in our popular culture anyway. Yeah. I hope the South is hanging on to some of that.
Yeah. Well, I hope the Midwest is hanging on to some of that, too. A friend of yours from Rochester, New York, by the name of Charlie, asked you when Claire, your daughter, your firstborn, was just 6 months old, how do you raise a Southerner? What did you tell him?
Well, the first thing I did was hear my mother correcting his grammar in my head. Down here, we like to say that that folks aren't raised. Cattle are raised. People are reared. And I didn't express that to Charlie at the time, but that was my first thought. But in that conversation, I went on to try to explain to him how we were the only region of the country to lose a war fought on our own territory. to explain to him about the fundamentalist religious influences in our culture. And all those things that, as I say in a piece in the book, that I learned in my political science class in college. But after he went home, I got to thinking about what is it that really makes a Southerner? And I think it's less those broad, poli-sci, pedantic type things that the academics tell us, and it's more about the little things that we do day in and day out. How we talk, what we wear, and our rules and values and mores. And so I go on in that piece in the book to tell a little bit about what I think makes a Southerner, how to rear a Southerner.
Mm. Charlie at that time was on his way to a job in New Orleans. And I wonder if a guy from New York who moves him.
I don't know. Charlie and I've had a couple of subsequent conversations about that, and I think he's been fairly well indoctrinated into Southern culture. But at that, New Orleans, as a part of the South, is distinctly different mm-hmm. from Jackson, Mississippi, as a part of the South, or Bessemer, Alabama, or any other small town South. You definitely get a different culture in New Orleans, just like you get a different culture in Miami and Atlanta that probably aren't reflective of the traditional South that I speak of for the most part in the book. And by traditional, I mean that in complementary terms. Certainly there are things that are a part of our history and culture that we're not too proud of in retrospect. But there's an awful lot of good, and I think you pick those up, again, off the beaten path in the South. Charlie has learned to like Southern cooking, and we talk every now and then about the latest colloquialism that he's heard and picked up and needs me to interpret for him. So I don't know if he's been changed by it, but I hope he's come to share, I guess, our sense of the place and what it means to be and do and live down here.
Yeah. Now, might he use the bless your heart rules?
Oh, certainly. Although that is, I think, a uniquely Southern expression. In Due South, there's a piece called the Bless Your Heart Rules, and the gist of my argument is that basically in the South, you can say anything you want to about another person as long as you bless their hearts. And it may come from some religious context, I'm not sure. But in the South, we use it in a couple of different ways, and you have to be careful when someone blesses your heart or when you bless someone's heart about what you mean, because context is everything. A level one bless your heart is sort of a sympathetic colloquialism. It's what we Southerners say when we don't know what else to say. You can't find a parking place, and it's pouring rain, and you had to run into the mall, and you're soaking wet. Well, bless your heart. Or you get an audit letter from the IRS. Well, bless your heart. Those are signs of sympathy, expressions of sympathy, a way of commiserating. It's what we say when we don't know what else to say. Mm. But there's another level of blessing hearts that I believe is a little more interesting, certainly a little more insidious. And that is the Southerner's penchant for using bless your heart as a way to skewer an adversary, to say what otherwise is unspeakable in polite conversation. We can throw in a bless your heart, and if we use just the right sympathetic tone, we can turn a verbal kick in the pants into a nice pat on the arm.
Yeah.
Sort of like, let's see.
Maybe
Arlene's hair may be blonde, bless her heart, but her roots aren't.
All right. Maybe you would read us that piece.
Yeah, let me get to it here. It has become the signature piece, colloquialism, one of those definition-defying, uniquely Southern ones. We're not sure exactly what it means, but it sounds sympathetic, and we're sincere when we say it. In fact, it's exactly what we say when, well, when there's nothing else to say. It's how we commiserate. We reserve bless your hearts for those whom we perceive to be aggrieved, powerless, treated unfairly, violated, infringed upon, or generally inconvenienced in some way. Couldn't find a parking space? Bless your heart. Wife run off on you? Bless your heart. You're the mother of three or more children under age five? Bless your heart, and heaven help you. There's also the bless your heart reserved for babies, generally for fussy or homely-looking ones, always uttered in baby talk. Bless its little heart. That's a level one. Now, a level two bless your heart is something else entirely. In this more insidious and interesting form, it's the preferred way of pointing out another person's inadequacies, of mentioning what otherwise would be unmentionable in polite conversation. It's softer, more palatable than a direct insult. Throw in a bless your heart, uttered with the appropriate sympathetic tone, and a verbal kick in the pants is transformed into a reassuring pat on the arm. Bless your heart, Billy Sue, you put dark meat in your chicken salad. Or, poor thing got knocked up at the prom, bless her heart. Patronizing, yes, but it's always polite. In the South, we've raised this second variety of heart blessing to an art form. Wielded correctly, it's a poison cherry dipped in the rich chocolate of genteel Southern manners, a condescending confection sprinkled with saccharin and sympathy, zinger masquerading as bon mot. A level two bless your heart conveys at least a trace of real sympathy. It appears to be concerned while slyly drawing attention to someone else's flaws. It's the weapon of choice for taking a pot shot at an adversary because it can be so done so darn nicely. Sort of like complimenting a friend on her dress, then asking if she made it herself. This kind of heart blessing is most effective in pointing out perceived inadequacies in someone else's intelligence or skill or personal taste. For instance, bless her heart, Kathy Lee didn't know those clothes were made by 9-year-old Honduran children. Or, when it comes to charisma, Al Gore's a wooden Indian, bless his heart. It also may be appropriately aimed at beauty pageant contestants, as in, our Miss Mississippi's a doll, but that Miss North Dakota, bless her heart. In this context, it's a quaint way of saying, that girl should be embarrassed to be seen in that getup, but she's not. Can you believe it? That's not to say that bless your heart can be used with equanimity toward any and everyone, at least when a Southern conservative is doing the heart blessing. Indeed, there are some folks for whom some Southerners harbor such scorn and contempt that they'd die before they offered them a sympathetic bless their heart. With some folks, why beat around the bush, we figure. Just insult them outright. They've earned it. I'd wager the words bless her heart and Hillary Clinton have never been uttered in the same breath, at least not south of the Mason-Dixon line, not even in Arkansas. Ditto Ted Kennedy, General William Tecumseh Sherman, and Boutros Ghali. Heck, even George Wallace and Richard Nixon were later rehabilitated with a bless his heart or two. But Yankee liberals are another matter. The only other pointer I'd give to a heart blesser in training is this. You know you've mastered the art of bless your heart when you can do it, then leave the remainder of the comment unfinished, and the listener immediately perceives the inadequacy you're pointing out. That Dan Quayle, bless his heart. The voice trails off. Some things just go without saying, and probably should.
Thank you for reading that to us. You know, I'll occasionally use a bless your heart, but it's more like a thank you or for a kindness.
And I imagine that's how it began, but only because of Southern manners and the way we are less inclined to really say something nasty about somebody. We soften it, and that's, I think, where bless your heart came from, a way to still get across the meanness, but to hide it, to cloak it as best you can.
Mm. You know, I enjoyed reading Due South very much, and one of the things I was struck, though, is how much, really, we have in common. We're not from different planets. Maybe we're from a different part of the same planet, but there's so much here that we share. I'll take lawn ornaments, for example, and your essay, Southern Provincial. Now, wherever I've been, someone or some number of folks are decorating their yards with lawn art and plastic figures. Springfield, Illinois, old iron bathtubs dug into the ground housing a statue of the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, yeah. And you may see that occasionally in the South. The difference, I think, and you may correct me, is that in the South you see these things in the nicest neighborhoods. I mean, you see plastic deer and chickens and pigs and a big old cutout of Grandma's backside sitting in the flower bed in nice neighborhoods with protective covenants that apparently protect against everything but that.
Yeah, that's different. That's different.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Have you ever been tempted to put something in the yard?
I've not, but to my embarrassment, my mother has. She's gotten into the lawn decoration bit, and particularly on holidays, but she has a flag that she changes out with the seasons, and when it's a special holiday, she'll put up the different colored flag representing the season. She says it's for the grandkids, but I suspect otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Other similarities. In Southern Berlitz, I was struck by some of the sayings. Crack the window, mm-hmm. meaning open the window. Why we say that here. Also, turn the air up, which means really set the thermostat lower.
Correct.
We say those things, although Ned and the First Reader was
that
a new one.
Remains, yeah.
That's a new one on me.
That one remains lost on me. That's my grandmother's saying, and all I can figure is that it has something to do with unwashed little boys. When I was a kid, we would go down and get to spend some time playing out in the hills and hollows of my grandparents' farm. And when I'd come in for lunch, my grandmother would tell me to go wash up, that I looked like Ned in the First Reader. I have had readers tell me, since the book's come out, that it apparently has something to do with a school textbook from the 20s and 30s or so. But again, it's fairly obscure in my judgment.
Yeah. Now, there's also an old colloquialism there that I think many folks are going to be familiar with. And I think, didn't we come across this in Chaucer, breaking wind?
I don't know. That would be, you may educate me on that. That is a polite way of
I'm parting the air.
Yeah. I'm trying to grasp at the nicest definition of passing gas, and that's what we Southerners say, at least in polite company. There are certainly some other, a little more colorful, less polite expressions, but that's probably the only one that you can use with your grandmother around or with the at the ladies' Bible study.
Yeah. Also, this was Bukus.
Yeah. A buku, in the South at least, is some inestimable measure, as in, there's just bukus and bukus of apples on that tree. It means an awful lot, obviously, but I think it comes from the French, and I don't know how it made the conversion to Southern speak, but of course the root is probably beaucoup, which I think I haven't taken French, but I think it means much, very much, and we sort of I guess bastardized it a little bit and changed it to beaucoups. So all my life growing up, when we wanted to express that there was an awful lot of something, we said there were just beaucoups mm-hmm. of it.
There's a little stream in Southern Illinois, and it is spelled B-E-A-U-C-O-U-P, Boku, although the locals say it, buck up, buck up crick.
Well, that's a new one on me.
Yeah. Illinois is an interesting place because, you know, Chicago's at one end, and but at some point as you go south, you're actually closer to the South than you are to Chicago. You're closer to Memphis, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, an interesting state. When did you start riding?
That's a difficult question, too. I was blessed to have a mother who put a pen in my hand at an early age and encouraged me to use it in a number of ways. I've always been enthralled with words. I spent an awful lot of time as a kid, I'm embarrassed to say, reading the dictionary. And in college, decided to minor in English and got to write a bit there. That's where I met Sarah Palmer, a college professor of mine who was really encouraging of me and apparently saw something in my abilities that was worth encouraging. And so it was with Sarah Palmer that I first began to think that, well, you know, maybe I have at least something of a knack for this. Majored in finance and minored in English and did that to get a job. And it worked. I got a job. But the writing sort of, at least the writing that is in Due South, sort of came about by chance. I had not set out to write essays, much less anything, but lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for a bit, and my commute uptown was about an hour. I only lived 12 miles south of town, but the traffic was pretty terrible there. And the only thing there was to do in the commute was to listen to public radio. Or listen to the radio. I chose public radio. The station there, WFAE, was a fine station. They used, well, they not only had All Things Considered and Morning Edition and all the fine NPR programs, but occasionally they would use local North Carolina commentators, and some of them were very good. Well, I was just cocky enough at the time to wonder if I couldn't do something like that. Wasn't long after that I accepted a position in Jackson, moved here, and one of the first things I noticed was that public radio in Mississippi didn't use an awful lot of local voices. And again, this cocky streak in me rose up, and I, over a couple of weeks, sat down and penned a couple of essays that are in the book, Chapstick, and an essay called Ada Jean. And sent them to PRM, and a month, 6 weeks or so went by, and I pretty much figured, well, that was worth a shot. When one day I get a call from a fella named Kevin Farrell. Kevin was a producer at Public Radio in Mississippi, and he said, you know, we like this. We've been thinking about doing, trying to develop some Mississippi voices. We'd like you to come in and do a demo. Came in. Kevin and William Fulton, the station director, apparently liked what they heard and invited me to begin a regular commentary on PRM. Well, I was a bit surprised, needless to say, mostly because those were the only two essays in my portfolio. So I agreed to do it, of course, and hurried home to begin to write some pieces. So now my public radio in Mississippi spot airs every other week. And then in September of 97, NPR picked up the first essay, and there have been somewhere between 15 and 20 or so of the pieces that are in the book that have also aired on All Things Considered. Mm. So a series of coincidences that were driven, I guess, by the fact that I really enjoy writing. Again, I guess I'm cocky enough to think that I can do it kind of well.
I think you do it very well. You do it very well. And I envy those folks down there in Mississippi who get to hear you every other week, because on All Things Considered, we only hear you occasionally.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about it, ever since 1996, March 1996, when I began the pieces on PRM, I have gotten wonderful phone calls. In fact, one call when my twin sons were born, a fellow who confessed he liked the essay but was really more interested in selling me insurance for the, for my new boys. But a lot of letters, email. What's interesting, though, to me is what really strikes a chord among these Southerners. Public radio in Mississippi airs statewide, so I get input from across the state. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the things that I talk about that I would expect might rile people a bit don't, and the things that I would think they would just laugh at and enjoy are the very things that they tend to call up and tell, well, Kevin Farrell, the producer, tends to take most of the heat now, but they will express their concern over what I've had to say, and in no uncertain terms, tell me what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
For instance, there's a piece in the book called "Come Out, Eudora, Wherever You Are."
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece about some friends of mine who bought the house next door to Eudora Welty. Miss Welty, Pulitzer Prize winner, Legion of Honor recipient, basically the grand dame of Southern letters, lives here in Jackson, and this is a community that is very protective of Miss Welty. They view her as an icon and a treasure, and there were some who felt like in that piece I overstepped my bounds. The gist of the piece is my imagined me imagining the efforts of my friends to get to meet Miss Welty. Miss Welty has not been in great health for several years now and doesn't get out much, but Larry and Emmy, my two friends, were pretty determined that they were going to meet their next-door neighbor. When the piece aired, and I thought it was a fairly humorous piece, we got two letters that were basically of a how-dare-you tone, and this was in poor taste, and on and on. And so I was duly chastened, I guess, until NPR picked it up, and they loved it and aired it up there. But I have to be sort of careful. There are things folks down here take very seriously, and I'm never quite sure, though, what's gonna get which kind of response from listeners.
Yeah. Well, some of the pieces in Due South contain some political barbs, but
I'm an equal opportunity offender.
Yeah. But I wouldn't call what you do political commentary at all. But I'm wondering, you know, you have a master's degree in political science. Would you like to write political commentary, or are you writing political commentary?
I have not written much of it. Only a couple of the pieces that have aired on PRM have been even remotely political in nature. I have a great interest in politics. It has to do with my profession. I work for a business trade association. I am something called an association executive. My editor at Villard had to have a lengthy discussion with me to determine exactly what that was.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, the association I work for definitely is involved in local national politics. And so I have to have some awareness and knowledge of it. I certainly have strong opinions, and I think I like to present those views in a whimsical way. I guess if I could do my dream job, I would be a speechwriter for a political candidate, because I think that would allow me to use the writing that I love with also the politics that I have an interest in. But we'll see where life leads.
Yeah. Did you ever consider becoming a teacher?
I come from a family of teachers. My mother is one of five, and four of the five in her family were school teachers. My younger sister became a first-grade teacher. But I didn't. Growing up in the South, particularly in Alabama, I was a product of state schools, and the son of a mother who I would hear frequently lament the fact that she loved what she did, but teacher pay was just abysmal during my growing up, and to some extent still is. I just never seriously considered it. Now, in retrospect, I wonder if I might not have enjoyed teaching, perhaps at the college level, particularly related to writing and literature, which are teachers dreaded because of my sarcasm and wit and all of that. I was absolutely that. My grades were my grades were pretty good. I was what my mother would term, not affectionately, a smart aleck.
Mm. Bless your heart.
Yeah.
Well, would you read us another one of the columns? This is one that you stopped me cold with on the road. I had to pull off into a parking lot, and that was Chapstick.
Yes, let me get to the page here.
And this is about your dad.
Yes, and yeah. Chapstick was the first piece that was written. It's one of the pieces that I sent to PRM early on. And at that time, it was a very recent experience. And still to this day, it's very moving. My father cannot hear me read it without getting a little bit teary. It's a special piece to me, so Chapstick. In the corner of a large, open room in the cardiac intensive care unit, my father lay on his back on a gurney, tubes and wires and hoses running from his mouth, nose, chest, and gut. Pop's face was a pale gray-blue, unnatural, the color of rainwater as it runs off a gravel road. He looked absolutely lifeless, save for the steady whoosh and moan of a ventilator and the up and down of his chest as the machine breathed for him. Nurses hovered near, everywhere, checking monitors, thumping gauges, reading charts, and taking pulse amid the whir and buzz of the life-sustaining equipment. I marveled at their fortitude and skill. They'd shaved most of his body just prior to the surgery, Pop complaining all along. The orderly had joked with him about how much easier it would make wearing pantyhose. Now, his skin, normally tan and leathery, was dry and unnaturally cold to my touch. I took one long look at him, then turned away. Despite my best efforts, a sob escaped my throat, and I wondered why, at 30 years old, I was having trouble reconciling this view of a small, vulnerable, terribly human-looking shape before me with that vibrant, bigger-than-life figure who'd been such a remarkable influence on my growing up. His upper body was uncovered, and a huge bandage, secured by inch-wide strips of white tape, ran the length of his shaved chest. Just a few hours and four bypasses earlier, his heart had been troubled by blockages that only a week before he had known nothing about. Surgeons had made an incision in his chest, sawed through his sternum, exposed the ailing 52-year-old organ, and, taking a vein from his right leg, somehow repaired it. Now, supposedly, he was on his way to recovery. His appearance suggested otherwise. And then our 15 minutes were up. Back in the relative warmth of the waiting area, with its institutional blue and gray-striped wallpaper, I considered the irony of the word visitation, at least in this context. The well-meaning nurse had called it visitation, but there was no sharing or exchange involved here. What we'd just done was view the body. They'd told us to brace ourselves for the first visit after he'd come out of surgery, yet I was in no way prepared for what I'd just seen. But they said he was doing well. 3 hours later, when we were finally ushered back in, my mother and I were startled and relieved to find Pop awake, sort of. Still gray and cold, terribly groggy, but awake. A nurse explained again that he was doing remarkably well despite how he looked. His eyes, half open, had a hard time focusing on us. A thick tube extending down his throat and into his lungs prevented him from speaking. His normal modesty was betrayed by a flimsy white hospital sheath that barely covered his hips. Better he wasn't coherent, I thought. He wouldn't like this one bit. My mother kissed him on the forehead and smoothed his ruffled hair. Pop tried to raise his right hand to touch her cheek, but his arm was tethered to an IV line. Instead, she took the hand and squeezed it. She loosened her grip, and he began to wiggle his finger. It took us a moment to realize that, groggy as he was writing. Slowly and clumsily, he spelled with his index finger on the bedsheet. L-O-V-E-Y-O-U. It was a major gesture from one so weakened. My mother brightened for an instant. The relief and emotion in her eyes were palpable. The finger began again, spelling out another letter, but we were unable to discern it. "Try again, Pop," I said. He waved the hand back and forth slowly on the sheet as if to erase his false start. Then slowly he spelled S-A-M-U-E-L and a question mark. I smiled at his query, at his attention to the punctuation, and at the concern of a grandfather asking about the 3-year-old grandson, my sister's son, he adored. "He's fine, Pop," I said. "He's asking for you." His eyes brightened for an instant, felt utterly powerless to do anything to ease his obvious discomfort or to speed his recovery. His condition was in the hands of physicians and machines and God and the esoteric power of the body to heal itself. I surveyed him, the pale face, the disheveled hair, the hose protruding from his throat. and my eyes came to rest at his lips, cracked, nearly bleeding, chapped lips thrust apart by an offensive but essential ventilator pipe plunged down his throat and into his lungs. Here were the worst chapped lips I'd ever seen, and here was opportunity. I reached into my pocket, pulled out a small cylinder, and removed the top. I rubbed balm onto his lips, around the pipe, top and bottom, gently, carefully. He blinked again, and in his weary eyes I think I saw affection, or relief, something, and I felt better too. I slipped the tube of stuff back into my pocket, squeezed Pop's hand one more time, and walked back to the waiting room, convinced as never before of the power of prayer and modern medicine and chapstick.
Thanks. Scott Bruner, our guest this afternoon, reading from his book Due South, Dispatches from Down Home. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Where do you do your writing? Do you do it daily?
I try to write daily. With three small children, that can be difficult sometimes. We recently moved from one part of Jackson to another. In the first house, I wrote in a little, it was actually a closet, but I made an office out of it, a little cubbyhole off the master bedroom. And every night, most nights, when my wife would go to bed and we would get the kids down, I would ensconce myself in there and peck away at my laptop, trying to meet this every other week deadline that I had with PRM. We've recently moved to the new house, and I have my own study, still fairly small, but I've found me a desk chair that's really comfortable, and so I still manage to do most of my writing late at night. For some reason, I can't be as productive in the morning or afternoon, but at the end of the day, for some reason, the creative juices flow, and that's where I tend to get the most done.
Mm. Now, with the twins, how's diaper duty coming along?
Well, we're still in that phase, unfortunately.
You must have quite a sense of character going for you now.
Yeah, sense is an interesting word choice there. I was amazed when our daughter was born. She's 3 and a half, she'll be 4 in January, about what a chore changing diapers was. And so, like any good male, I guess, I left it to my wife, and more particularly to the two grandmothers, my mother and my wife's mother, to do. Then we had twin boys, and life changed. Where first, with our daughter, my wife was a little more forgiving and understood that how repugnant I found changing diapers. When there are two, that's twice the number of diapers, and she's not nearly so forgiving. So, as I say in the book, poo-poo builds character, and I've got about all the character I can handle right now.
Yeah. Do you cook?
No, cooking makes me nervous, and that's interesting. As I've been out promoting the books and fresh vegetables and all kinds of things spread out over the kitchen, and you would think that that would be something that I enjoy, but you get all that stuff spread out, and all I can think of is that I got to clean it up, so it makes me nervous. My wife, though, is a fabulous cook.
Yeah, well, I was kind of wondering if you could turn out a good sweet potato pie.
Oh, no, but I can tell you about a sweet potato pie. We have as you'll read in the book, we have an ongoing debate in our family about sweet potato pie. And I have my own opinions about how sweet potato pie would be.
Yeah. Now, your version of sweet potato pie, I'm sorry to say, I've never had. I guess I've been in the camp that's always had the other kind. Just sort of your wife's favorite is kind of just a straight no-nonsense sweet potato pie.
Thoroughbred in every way, mm-hmm. Yeah. My wife's grandmother, until she passed away a couple of years ago, had always been the queen of sweet potato pie in my wife's family. And it was lovely pie. It was this bright orange color, and she put in it all the things you'd expect to be in sweet potato pie. Sweet potatoes and eggs and milk, sugar and a nice crust, and it was delicious. But it wasn't what I grew up on. Again, being the son, I guess, of a home economics teacher. My wife, my mother, in the kitchen was a little more willing to experiment. And so her sweet potato pies were downright extravaganzas. I mean, she put everything in the pie that she could think of. So sweet potato pie in our family had orange rind and coconut and cinnamon and allspice and brown sugar and milk and eggs, of course, and sweet potatoes to taste. And it was, she'd serve it on a pretty plate with a hot cup of coffee, and it was just melt in your mouth good. But my wife and I still have this ongoing debate about which is preferred, and at Thanksgiving we'll go to see my folks, and Mom will have sweet potato pie, and we'll go to Karen's folks, and now her mother makes the sweet potato pies, and we'll get our share of each. But Karen, my wife, maintains that my mother makes glorified sweet potato casserole, and my response to that is, what's your point?
And your daughter, Claire, now she's about 3 years old. Is she old enough to have an opinion on sweet potato pie?
I don't know yet. Claire's palate has proven to be something of a little bit of a disappointment so far. There's a piece in the book that I call The Heretic, and it's about Claire and her eating habits.
Yeah.
That piece was written, gosh, I guess 18 months ago or more, but the challenge continues. The child will not eat meat. I mean, she'll eat bologna and hot dogs, but I think it's really a stretch to consider those things meat. And in the South, not eating meat is darn near heresy. I mean, I grew up, most traditional Southerners grew up with mamas and grandmamas who filled the table with not only with fresh vegetables, but with fried chicken and smoked turkey and hams and fried catfish. And, you know, we'd even fry up squirrel now and then and make lunch of it. Meat, is the sine qua non, I guess, of the Southern sideboard. Yeah. And so to have a daughter who doesn't share my love of animal flesh, I guess, is a bit of a disappointment. I'm sort of concerned about how my parents and grandparents react when we go to visit them, and all she'll eat is macaroni and cheese, and occasionally green beans and butter beans and such.
Well, it's still early.
Yeah, I hope.
Still early. Quite early. Well, I want to wish you and your family the very best, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Scott Bruner has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, Due South, Dispatches from Down Home. It's published by Villard.